This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins.
Hello. My name's Forrest. Forrest Gump.
Hi, Forrest.
Do you want a chocolate?
No, not now.
I could eat about 1.5 million of these. My mom always said life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
Mmm, tasty. Particularly if you lose that piece of paper in the sampler box telling you what each chocolate contains. But that's half the fun, isn't it? I mean, biting into something sweet, not knowing what it's going to be exactly, but really not caring all that much because it's, well, sweet. And Forrest Gump isn't alone in the fact that he could be... I didn't write this right. And Forrest Gump is not alone in that fact. The fact that he could be 1 million of those chocolate morsels. The candy business is big business because America loves candy. Confectioners sell $25 billion worth of candy in this country alone every year. And although the industry employs tens of thousands of workers, many of the candy manufacturers are actually small, often family-owned businesses. In advance of what could be the biggest candy day of the year, Valentine's Day, we're going to talk about candy and sweets, the good, the bad, with Clay Gordon, author of Discover Chocolate and the creator of the website, thechocolatelife.com. Welcome to the program. Nice to have you with us.
Good morning. It's great to be here from New York.
Mr. Gordon is in New York, and joining us by phone from Washington is Susan Whiteside. She's Vice President of Communications for the National Confectioners Association. Good morning to you.
Good morning, everyone.
And in our studios is Chef Jeffrey Blunt, who heads up the Baking and Pastry Arts Program on the Harris campus of the Central Piedmont Community College. He also has numerous awards to his credit, not the least of which are the 2011 Charlotte Pastry Chef of the Year and Educator of the Year awards, and his dessert creations were featured at both the 2004 and 2005 James Beard dinners. And you've brought... chocolate.
Oh, yeah. We had to bring some chocolates from the campus this morning.
So you made these chocolates on campus?
The students. Actually, currently, right now, our students are in the middle of a final exam with the snowstorm looming. So there is chocolate abound all over the shop at the Harris campus.
Well, let me begin with Susan here, because I'm just curious about what the biggest holiday for candy of the year is. I assumed it was Valentine's Day, but then Halloween popped into my mind. So which is the biggest day of the year for candy?
Well, there are two answers to that question. The biggest season for candy is definitely Halloween. In fact, Valentine's Day ranks number 4 in terms of overall season.
What?
The holidays are in order: Halloween, Easter, Christmas, and the winter holidays, and then Valentine's Day. But Valentine's Day itself, February 14th, is the largest single sales day for boxed chocolate in the country.
Ah. Is Valentine's Day lower on the list than the other three, possibly because flowers and dinners out are options where they are not options on Halloween?
Well, my parents go out to dinner on Halloween so that they are not home.
It might be kind of smart.
I don't think they are influencing the overall sales that much.
And the
I think that's certainly part of it, but I think also on Valentine's Day, you probably give candy to fewer people. So certainly to your sweetheart, maybe to your children, maybe to your mother, but that's pretty much it. You have a couple of Valentines, and that's about it.
Hmm.
Whereas on Halloween, you're giving candy to everyone in your office, every kid that comes to your door, and similarly for Christmas, your aunt might get a nice box, you put some out for your Christmas party, you put it in the Christmas stockings, and so forth.
And interestingly enough, I read this yesterday, and you can confirm or deny this, Susan, that until the early to mid-1950s, Halloween was not a candy holiday. Once again, the baby boomers have had their influence, had their way on the world through Halloween candy. Is that true?
That is true. So if you love trick-or-treating and the customs around that, you can certainly thank a baby boomer. It was the sort of close-in suburban communities that started, mostly in the Northeast, that started trick-or-treating. It spread relatively quickly throughout the U.S. So, you know, by the 1960s, and it was pretty well accepted all across the country. But can you imagine the first community that went trick-or-treating, you know, when someone rang your doorbell dressed in a costume and demanded you give them candy, how that must have gone over?
Mm. Yeah, because they used to give boxes of cereal and things like that, which As a kid, I don't know what my reaction would have been. I think toilet paper on the trees might have been my reaction to that. Prior, though, to Halloween becoming a candy holiday, I also read yesterday, there was an actual day on the calendar called Candy Day in 1916, and it was to be observed on the second Saturday of October, a day when every man, woman, and child would be urged to see to it that someone was sent a box or bag or bucket of candy. And then after World War I, it morphed into the sweetest day when you were supposed to give candy to elderly people and orphans. Now, things like that don't disappear. How did this day disappear?
Sweetest Day is still celebrated. It is not one of the major holidays in terms of candy or in terms of just sort of general social celebrations, but it is, you will still find it on the calendar. It's interesting. A lot of times I hear people refer to it as a Hallmark holiday, but in fact, as you see, there's actually quite a long and storied history behind most of the holidays that we celebrate, including Sweetest Day, but also including Valentine's Day, mm-hmm. which has been celebrated for a very, very long time. So the way we celebrate it has changed over the years.
You know, a lot of holidays seem to be so-called Hallmark holidays because it's an excuse to go to the card store and buy a card and sign it and send it to somebody, which, of course, short-circuits any meaningful communication because all you do is buy a pre-printed poem and put your name on it and put it in the mail or hand it to somebody. But Hallmark keeps getting the rap. It seems to me that the candy industry is behind some of these holidays because you guys are pumping it out on Halloween, Christmas, Easter, and Valentine's. And I'm sure you'll come up with another one soon. Are you actively behind this stuff?
Well, you know, it's difficult to say that we are active participants, actively behind it. I would have to say no. You know, but certainly you're going to see you're going to see candy companies out there offering products to consumers when they're looking for them. So, you know, we're talking orange and black packaging around Halloween and heart-shaped things and cinnamon, spicy cinnamon, mm-hmm. and red and pink at Valentine's Day. Active participants, certainly.
Clay, I know that you've been all over the world in your endeavors as a chocolate expert and a lover of chocolate, and your website, thechocolatelife.com, is kind of an aggregator of all things chocolate. Most of the contributions are from other chocolate lovers, with you putting your 2 cents worth in from here or there. But is there any other country in the world that has so many candy holidays?
Well, I think that Americans are unique in their embrace of these things, just the zealousness with which we throw ourselves into them. I mean, the United States is the largest single candy and chocolate market in the world. There are other countries that eat more chocolate on an individual basis, mm-hmm. but when you think about the United States as a market, it's in total – we end up being the biggest single market in the world. And therefore, there's a lot of value in companies promoting these events and getting people interested in them because they represent, you know, a very large percentage of the overall world market. But I do want to make, you know, one little observation about the difference between Halloween and Valentine's Day. Mm-hmm. Not only are we giving chocolate to different people, as was pointed out, on Halloween we're giving it to people who – strangers for the most part who walk up to our door. And in Valentine's Day we're giving it to a very small group of people. But we're also giving very different kinds of chocolates. I mean, I make a distinction between candy, mm-hmm. which tends to be sweeter and probably has less chocolate in it. And then, you know, really high-quality chocolates and confections, bonbons and truffles, something that you might go to a local chocolatier, you know, in Charlotte or someplace like that. And so we need to be aware of the distinction between, you know, a candy bar like we might get in a supermarket mm-hmm. and this quality product that we've purchased to demonstrate our affection.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second because it seems to be on Halloween and Easter. Those are kid candy holidays.
Yeah, yeah. Kid candies.
And so you'll go out and you'll buy the chocolate bunny, which is probably not very good chocolate, but it's chocolatey and it looks brown and has ears you can break off and let them dissolve in your mouth. But for Valentine's Day and for Christmas, it seems that the better chocolates are given and consumed. Would that be right, Susan?
Well, I think for both Valentine's Day and Christmas, you see a wider variety. So, yes, I think a lot of the sort of favorite iconic American brands are included in more in Halloween and Easter. I think you still see those brands quite a bit at Valentine's Day and at Christmas, but you also see some of the more locally made craft or artisan chocolates, as well as premium chocolates that you can buy in mass channels as well. So you,
Chef,
things like Lindt and Ghirardelli and products like that.
Chef, you teach young people how to make these
right.
things, not just candy, but
not
all kinds
candy.
Of all kinds of sweet things. When a young person comes to you and they've grown up on candy bars that come from the drugstore or the checkout line at the supermarket, and you teach them how to make really good chocolate, what's their first impression?
Well, the very first thing we do on the very first day of chocolate class is I have 62 pieces of chocolate. And of course, some of it is not chocolate. It's white chocolate, which we call the white lie, and cocoa butter and cocoa powder. And
yeah, there's no chocolate in white
there's
chocolate.
There's no chocolate in white chocolate. No. So we start them at the very top of 99%. And we do micro roast, micro plantation. We start to let them taste chocolate much like we would go to a wine shop and taste wine. Let it melt in your mouth slowly, no cold water. Breathe in a little bit of air, pick up some of the nuances. You start to taste things, and this is where you get away from that Hershey that's a 48% milk solids and sugar. And there's nothing wrong with Hershey. I mean, it's good, or else it wouldn't be selling for all these years. But yeah, when you start getting into those 58s, 60s, 70s, 80s,
58, 60, 70, 80, what
percentage of cacao, which means okay. actual dark. So when you start getting that number higher, you're getting a darker chocolate with a lot less milk solids and sugar and all those other things in there. So you can start picking up nuances.
There's a video on your website, Clay, where you talk about having a chocolate tasting and how to cleanse your palate, how to approach it not unlike a wine tasting. Are there tricks to the trade?
Well, there are tricks to the trade. I mean, yes. I mean, the most important thing to bring to any kind of chocolate tasting is a sense of humor. I mean, in the end, it's just
yeah, this
chocolate.
Is true.
It's just chocolate. You know, don't take yourself too seriously. You can geek out about it and all that other kind of stuff. But, you know, chocolate, unlike many other things, is really all about fun and sharing experiences. And that's, I think, the single most important thing to bring to a chocolate tasting. The other thing is, you know, have an open mind. We mentioned this notion of percentage and white chocolate and things like that. So the percentage of cocoa in a chocolate bar refers to how much of the bar by weight comes from the cocoa pod, right, cacao beans. Mm-hmm. And that is a combination of the powder, which is called non-fat cocoa solids, which is what gives chocolate its color, and the fat, which is called cocoa butter. So an 80% right bar of chocolate says out of 100 grams, 80 grams come from the cocoa pod, but 40 grams might be powder and 40 grams might be butter, or right. 60 grams might be powder and 20 grams might be butter. So it's we need to be very careful. There's no direct correlation between the percentage of cocoa that's in a bar and either quality or taste, because it doesn't give you any indication of, you know, how well the products have been processed and the care that's been gone into making them.
Clay
so you
Gordon,
need to be very careful.
Clay Gordon is the author of Discover Chocolate and runs this website called thechocolatelife.com. If you are a chocolate lover, you need to check that out. Susan Whiteside is Vice President of Communications for the National Confectioners Association. And in our studio, Chef Jeffrey Blunt from Central Piedmont Community College. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts presenting The Mountaintop, a play imagining the final hours of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. On stage this month at Booth Playhouse. Details at BlumenthalArts.org. Maybe you've heard us talk about this. Did you? And maybe you haven't. Did you know that WFAE has a food blog? It's called WFAE Eats. It covers everything from sustainable food to new happenings in the Charlotte culinary scene. And since we're talking about chocolate and all things sweet, check it out. Read more at WFAEats.org. We'll be right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, since 1970, the rate of winter warming per decade in the U.S. has accelerated significantly. Why some say it's time to think about the implications of a world without snow.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
L-E-S-T-L-E-S, Nestle's makes the very best.
Quick, I need something chocolatey. Nestle's quick, and it's gotta be something from Nestle's. Nestle's makes the very best.
Sweet dreams are made of this. Alpine White's the very best.
When it crunches, that's why I love Nestle Crunch.
And I love the morsels.
Dollhouse. It's good to be home.
N-E-S-T-L-E-S.
Catch some rays. Catch some rays in
Nestle Crunch.
Sweet dreams are made.
When it crunches, rays in
N-E-S-T-L-E-S. Nestle makes the very best.
I suppose that's a matter of opinion, but that I think that the commercial has every single product that Nestle made at one point.
That's a lot of products.
Wow. We're talking about chocolate and about candy today with Chef Jeffrey Blunt from CPCC, and they are doing a practical exam today on chocolate.
On chocolate.
And listening as they prepare, and you've brought some candies we're going to taste in a second by the students. Susan Whiteside is Vice President of Communications for the National Confectioners Association, and Clay Gordon is the author of Discover Chocolate. In that commercial, Nestle says they make the very best chocolate. And I don't know whether that's true or not, but I do know there is a distinct difference between the taste of Nestle's chocolate and Hershey's chocolate. I'm not sure who to ask this question of, since they
I do know the answer.
I do
know the answer to the question. I mean, Milton Hershey's genius is not that he made good chocolate, but that he made chocolate affordable. So in the late 1890s, early 1900s, he came up with a way to make milk chocolate so that anybody with a nickel in their pocket could afford to buy a bar. And prior to the Industrial Revolution, chocolate was mostly for people who had a fair amount of money. So Milton Hershey had a caramel business that he sold and went to the Chicago Exposition and bought some chocolate-making equipment off the floor and then went to Europe to figure out how to make chocolate. And he met with Henri Nestle and Daniel Peter, who had milk chocolate that they had made in Europe, and they wouldn't license Henri Nestle's patents for powdered milk. So he went to England and visited with the Fry family, and they were making a milk chocolate using a method called the crumb method, basically taking sweetened condensed milk and then adding ground up cocoa mass, cocoa liquor to it. And it turns out if you're – and so that's what Milton Hershey brought back to the United States in Pennsylvania, because he had access to a lot of milk where he was in Pennsylvania, and he decided to make sweetened condensed milk. And if you're not careful when you condense the milk, it goes slightly sour. And if you actually take a piece of high-quality European milk chocolate, Swiss milk chocolate or Belgian milk chocolate, and then taste it next to Hershey's milk chocolate, what you get is the flavor of slightly soured milk.
Now, what's in the Hershey's chocolate.
Yeah. So what happens is that nobody knew in the late 1890s, early 1900s, that that's how chocolate wasn't supposed to taste. Right? Milton Hershey, because of this industrial accident, created a chocolate, and by the time he figured out a way around it, everybody was used to the way it tasted. And so the chocolate that we're eating today is based on an industrial accident that happened more than 120 years ago, and it's one of the reasons why Europeans will look at Hershey's milk chocolate and Americans who like it and go, ooh, you guys like cheesy chocolate. And they literally mean cheese.
Cheesy.
when they say it.
That's right. It counteracts the sweetness.
Yeah.
I think that sourness kind of counteracts that overly sweet desire that we have here in the U.S.
Let me ask another question, and maybe Susan, you can answer this. I don't know. All of you can answer this. Maybe it's just a changing palate as you get older, but some of the chocolate candies that I remember absolutely salivating over, begging my parents, please let me have a Mars bar, please. They don't taste the same today. Mm-hmm. Have you changed the formula?
No, you have changed.
We changed.
Now, let me just say, it's possible that some of them have changed their formulas over the years, but what's far more likely is two things have happened. One, you didn't like broccoli when you were a kid and you didn't like Brussels sprouts and you like those things now, your own palate has changed over the years. And on top of that, you probably have lost some taste buds. It happens as we get a little bit older and things start to not taste the same to us. When you're a very small child, the first taste buds that develop for you will be sweet. That's why children love milk is sweet. It tastes very sweet to them. Small children love peas, and then as they get a little bit older, they like them less because their other taste buds are maturing and they can taste the other flavors. They've lost some of that ability to taste sweet. But then as we get even older, we start to lose some sensations in our taste buds. We like things that taste stronger. We start liking the taste of coffee when we're in our late teens or early 20s. We start liking the taste of dark chocolate. We start liking the taste of wine. So these things that are very strong flavors start to appeal more to us the older we get.
So that explains why we like more sophisticated chocolate flavors when we get older. The question is, do we understand what we're – is America or are Americans becoming more sophisticated in their palates when it comes to chocolate and candy in general? Are we catching up with the rest of the world? Because it is alleged that in France, in Belgium, they know what good chocolate is.
Right. I think for a lot of us, it's just a different – what do you like? It's your flavor. I mean, yeah. I like milk chocolate. Good milk chocolate.
So
good on you. Thank you. Thank you for stepping up and saying that.
Yeah, I do too.
I mean, I think that there's a stigma. I mean, the worst thing I think could happen. You guys remember the movie Sideways?
Yes.
You know, Paul Giamatti is out in the back with Michael Hayden Church or whatever, and he's saying, "If anybody orders the Merlot, I'm leaving." Right. And you get the sense that people, I can't own up to the fact that I like milk chocolate because somehow that's like some like moral defect in me.
Love it.
It's like white chocolate is the white Zinfandel of the wine world.
I have to remember that one in class.
Ultimately, I go through these tastings and, I can lay claim to being the world's first professional chocolate critic. And my goal has changed over the last 12 years into helping people understand why they like what they like. Not to say my taste is good and I'm the professional and you need to listen to what I have to say. And if you disagree with me, well, then you're wrong. Right. And that's not the way it works. That's not the way it works. Your sense of taste is your sense of taste. As it was pointed out, our taste matures over time. And when it comes to chocolate and coffee and things like that, it's because we don't grow up with a sensitivity to bitterness. And things that are very bitter to us taste very bad because they're associated with poisons. And it's the adults who needed to be able to taste poison in the environment to be able to keep the kids safe. There's this interesting physiology and also culturally. I mean, Americans tend to like Belgian chocolate and Swiss chocolate, Northern European chocolates, because in general those chocolates tend to be lighter and sweeter than chocolate that comes from Spain and France and Italy, which tends to be a little darker and a little more robust. I'm sorry.
That's okay. No, go ahead.
No, it's all a matter.
He's talking about here is the northern European chocolates are the Belgian ones are usually conched a lot longer and they're smoother, milkier, creamier. Even a Belgian company like Calibo has a dark chocolate at 60%. It's still very smooth and clean. It doesn't have sophistication. It's just – it's good Belgian chocolate.
So what have you brought? What how would you describe that chocolate?
There's a mixture here of a French – we have a couple of chocolates with French, like a Guayaquil, 64%. And then we also have some of the Belgians. I have some milk. We have some stuff with passion fruit. And then we have a new little toy of ours, which – I think it's coming back, and it's more in the candy area. It's called a melt-away. So it has some lauric fats, and don't get the lauric
I don't know
fats
what that are, is.
Right, lauric fats, coconut. In this case, it's coconut fat, which you find in all the health food stores now. Mm-hmm. And we mixed it with speculoos butter and mixed the two together with a little bit of white chocolate. And, of course, when you put it in your mouth, it just – the lauric fats melt at a really good temperature, and they just really milky, really creamy. And of course, right now, speculoos spice seems to be the really popular thing.
What do we like most about putting a piece of chocolate in our mouth? The fact, the mouthfeel of it, the temperature at which it melts, or just simply the chocolate flavor? I mean, I have a box of truffles, which are of course chocolate, severe chocolate candies covered in cocoa powder.
Covered in cocoa powder.
And I just like to just – I don't chew them. I just let them melt.
Let them melt. They just need to melt. I tell people all the time, if you're chewing chocolate, you've got problems.
So if I were to taste one of these, where would I begin?
I would say just you can start off with one of the melted ways, the lighter color right there.
This is actually chocolate. It's because it looks like, oh my gosh, it's melting in my hand.
It melts in your hand. So it's a melt away. And it literally just melts right in your mouth. Real creamy.
It doesn't taste like chocolate.
No, in actuality, this has, so I wanted to play a little bit with the candy world today. So this is, it's actually a roasted white chocolate. So we actually take the white chocolate and let the milk solids, caramelize a little bit, or Maillard actually. And it kind of gives you a little bit of caramel flavor.
Yes. It's delicious.
It takes white chocolate to another level.
It's delicious, but it doesn't taste like chocolate at all.
Right.
But it's delicious.
Yeah. I always tell you, start off with something light. In this case, if you're just doing a tasting, start off with something light, and then you can move up.
And you aren't kidding. It melts. I mean, you touch it.
It melts.
It starts melting
it
in
melts
your
immediately.
Hand.
You need to get him a napkin.
M&M's melt in your mouth, not in your hand.
Not in your hand.
You know that.
This melt away will melt everywhere.
I'll taste another piece in a second. Let this melt. But we're talking primarily about chocolate, but there's all kinds of candy that is not chocolate. And I'm just curious, does anybody know, Susan, how many different kinds of candies there actually are aside from chocolate?
Different types or different brands?
No, types.
Types. Oh, gosh. Dozens, certainly. I don't know the type. I do know.
Because I can only think of peppermint candies and candy corn. I can't think.
We do have a division in the industry called crystalline candies, non-crystalline candies, aerated candies, and then jelly candies, and then nut confections. And then there's the chocolates. So, I mean, we divide those up.
Okay. And I know that your organization, the National Confectioners Association, covers all chocolate and non-chocolate candy as well as gum, chewing gum.
Yeah.
I didn't know chewing gum was considered to be a confection.
Yes.
It is considered a confection. A lot of the companies that make it are also in the other worlds of confection, although that was not necessarily always the case. But today, Wrigley, for example, Wrigley Gum, they make dozens of gum brands that you know. They also are making Starburst and Skittles now.
Mm-hmm.
So after a merger of sorts with the Mars Chocolate Company. So they are definitely players in the industry, and I think gum, if you were to try to put it into another category, if you had given it, a tremendous amount of thought, you probably would have eventually settled on candy as the right category for it to fall into.
Candy, I guess, used to be a real, real big treat because sugar was rare. People didn't get sugar. And sometimes just getting the lump of sugar was enough.
Right.
Who cares about the candy part? Just give me the lump of sugar.
Right.
But as sugar became more prevalent, I guess so did candy. How long has the general availability and affordability of candy been a factor?
Well, it was around, I'm going to say, the late 1800s. Now, at that time, there were hundreds of candy companies in the United States making what was mostly considered, penny candy, the kind of thing that would have been sold in bulk in general stores and that kind of outlet. There were still a number of people making candy at home at that time as well.
Mm-hmm.
Sugar was beginning to be more readily available by then. Our association was founded in 1884, and there were we had 69 original members, but there were hundreds of companies at that time and up until around the turn of the century who were making sort of small batch candies and selling them in a regional area.
And, we have an obesity epidemic in this country. That's no secret. And I'm sure that candy consumption plays at least a small role in that. But the good news is, and I was actually surprised to read this, at least for chocolate lovers, that chocolate seems to have some healthful properties. What's in chocolate that makes it good for us in moderation?
Well, I definitely want to answer that question, but I want to address the first part of your statement as well. We do have an obesity problem and an epidemic in this country. The consumption of all foods and the lack of exercise, the lack of activity are what have led us to that. Chocolate and candy represent only about 2% of calories in the average American's diet. So just want to put that into perspective, that it is possible to enjoy candy and to consume candy in a way that is responsible and that fits into a healthy lifestyle.
Just don't eat the whole box of Whitman sampler when they give it to you.
That's right.
At least take a week to eat it, right?
Right.
But there is actually some very, very good news for people whose weakness is chocolate. There have been a lot of studies out there showing the various potentially healthful properties of chocolate. But one I think that's really interesting is a study that came out in the British Medical Journal. They looked at a bunch of other studies that had been done about this. And they came to the conclusion that people who eat chocolate the most often have a 37% lower risk of heart disease, a 31% reduced risk of diabetes, and a 29% lower risk of stroke compared to those who eat the least.
Do they know why?
Well, the research is still ongoing, but certainly chocolate is, we started to talk about this a little bit earlier, but chocolate is a plant-based food. It grows in tropical regions of the world, and so it does have some qualities that people look for in other plant-based foods, meaning that it has a high flavanol content when processed, when the less processing of chocolate that it occurs, the more of these properties may be present. So the research is still ongoing, and we are learning new things about chocolate all of the time. But there are some baseline facts that have already been established, which gives you a nice reason to eat chocolate.
Clay,
yes, there's it's one of the things about chocolate is it's an incredibly complex food, right? So it's very, very high in lots of different factors, which contribute to overall health. There are things in the fat, like olive oil and like coconut oil. It is a healthful fat, and the fat itself has been linked to things like increasing the SPF factor of the skin, so that it improves the health of the skin, but it also helps relax the blood vessels, and so improves the flow. There's something in there which is related to nitric oxide formation in the blood, which relaxes the bloodstream. But part of it is, if you think about it, most people eat chocolate and they sort of have this pause and they go, man. It just makes you relax and it makes you feel good, right?
Well, it's so a comfort food, isn't it?
Well, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And, the way I think about it is that I want to enjoy chocolate. I eat chocolate because it makes me feel good. I don't want to feel good about eating chocolate. So I'm sort of against this notion of turning chocolate into a nutraceutical, into a vitamin delivery vehicle.
Nutraceutical.
Right. Well, people are doing it. Let's take, this and add it to it, and now we've got, healthy chocolate. If you're really concerned about the health benefits of cocoa, there are ways to consume it which are better than others, and we can talk about those when we come back.
All right. We're going to take a break, and we'll do just that. And I want to hear from you because you're a chef and you deal with real food. Aside from just candy.
Yeah.
When we come back, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Kids for Conservation Summer Day Camp at Carolina Raptor Center, offering new camps, new fees, and new raptors this summer. Registration open on the web at carolinaraptorcenter.org. It's supposed to snow here tomorrow. Today, possibly, and for several days. And the Southeast is under this whole warning about snow. And the North and the Midwest has gotten tons of snow this year. But since the 1970s, the rate of winter warming per decade in the U.S. has accelerated significantly. In fact, they're having trouble with temperatures in Sochi, where it's in the 60s on the ski slopes. And there are those who believe that the northeastern ski areas in this country will be snow-free in 30 years. Why some say it's time to think about the implications of a world without snow, the topic of the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes on WFAE.
I'm Rachel Martin, and I know there's a lot going on in your world. Deadlines to meet, kids to carpool, life to manage. Your time is precious, and when you have some time to spend thinking about the larger world, I hope you'll turn to us. News to keep you informed, conversations to keep you inspired. Join me on Weekend Edition Sunday from NPR News.
News happens all weekend, and we'll keep you up on the latest with Weekend Edition, Saturday and Sunday from 8 to 10 on 90.7 WFAE.
Sometimes you feel like a nut.
Sometimes you don't.
Almond or nut nut.
Mounds don't.
Almond joys got rich milk chocolate.
Coconut and marshmallows too.
Mounds got deep dark chocolate and chewy coconut.
Sometimes you feel like a nut.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sometimes you don't.
Ooh. Peter Paul, Almond joys got nuts.
Peter Paul, Mounds don't.
Because.
Sometimes you feel like a nut. Sometimes you don't.
Of course, Mounds bars have dark chocolate, and
yes.
The Peter Paul Almond Joys have, I think, milk chocolate. We should be aware of that. We're talking chocolate and other candies with Chef Jeffrey Blunt from CPCC. He's a baking and pastry arts instructor out there, and he's brought candies that are absolutely stunningly gorgeous and delicious, by the way, that his students have made. Susan Whiteside, Vice President of Communications for the National Confectioners Association. She joins us by phone from Washington and in New York. Clay Gordon, author of Discover Chocolate and the proprietor of the ChocolateLife.com website. He's also, I think, the original chocolate critic. In the 1990s, there were no professional chocolate critics, and he decided to become one and to become a worldwide authority.
Not a bad job to have.
You know.
You know, somebody had to step into that gap. I was willing to go there.
We were talking about chocolate and wine tasting. At least at a wine tasting, you don't get inebriated because you're supposed to swish and spit. Now, you can't do that. I wouldn't think you can do that with a chocolate tasting.
I've been there and I've done that, and it's not pretty.
It's not pretty.
Okay. I was a judge at the International Chocolate Awards final judging in October in London, and we had to eat several hundred pieces of chocolate samples over the course of several days.
Mm.
And at some point, you just have to give up and say, I just can't eat all of this.
So is there a way to consume chocolate in a responsible way where you don't gain tons of weight or you don't make yourself unhealthy? I think you were going to talk about that a little bit.
Well, Clay, what I was going to do is say, if you're concerned about the health benefits of chocolate, you want to eat chocolate because it's healthy for you and you want to get the most out of the benefits, the best way is to go back and look at history and see how those cultures that seem to have consumed cocoa but don't have rates of heart disease and things like that, how they've done that, like the Kuna Indians in Panama, and they've drunk it.
Hmm.
And they've drunk it without lots of sugar.
Bosco.
Added to it.
Yeah.
So
I don't know about Bosco,
cocoa powder. You take a natural cocoa powder, which is unalkalized, right, and you add it to water or milk, your choice, and then add small amounts of sugar because sugar has been proven to help metabolize things because you're worried about the metabolites, the things that actually make it into your bloodstream. And it turns out that the body processes things that you drink differently from things that you eat.
Hmm.
And so those nutrients get into your digestive system and are more efficient at extracting out the things that are good for you.
So if you were to take a piece of solid chocolate candy and let it melt in your mouth and follow it with a water chaser, is that the same thing as drinking it?
Nope. Sorry.
Darn.
Sorry.
Because
something about fat solubility there.
Well, the moment you put it in your mouth, it gets your stomach going. Right? You start to chew it, you let it melt, all that kind of stuff. You're signaled to your stomach that, there's something coming in there that needs to be digested. However, if you just drink it down, it doesn't get digested in your stomach the same way.
Now, I said at the beginning of the program that this is a multi $25-32 billion industry in America alone. But that a lot of the proprietors, the manufacturers of chocolate, are small proprietors. How many small chocolate makers do we have here in town? Do you know, Chef?
Well, actual chocolate makers are making confections with a finished product, I guess would be the
I'm
next
not sure. What's the distinction?
So
what's the difference?
Up in New York, and Clay's there in New York, there's a lot of chocolate shops that actually manufacture their own chocolate from bean to bar, meaning they're getting in the raw beans and actually, doing the roasting and the winnowing and the whole process. Here in Charlotte, we don't really have anybody that's doing that full process yet.
So they're buying bars of certain kinds of chocolate and then making
these. And really good quality too. That I know of, no one here in Charlotte is. We do have a company in Asheville, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. French Broad.
Yeah, the French Broad is
Dan
doing
Radigan,
their own.
He does great work.
Awesome stuff. But that's rare that somebody's doing complete bean to bar. Although we do have a lot of confectioners here in Charlotte. We have 20 Degrees. We have Secret Chocolatier. We have Bar Coco. There's a lot of different places.
We've made a big deal, at least in this city, and I'm sure it's happening in other towns around the country, of having breweries pop up. We have a lot of boutique breweries in Charlotte now, and people love to go out and taste the beer and have found their favorites. The same thing has happened with coffee. Mm-hmm. Is this going to happen with chocolate?
I think so. It's going to replace all of our cupcake shops, that's for sure.
It's already happened.
Oh, yeah.
It's already happened. As a matter of fact, one of the things that's most exciting, I think, in the world of chocolate, from my perspective, is that the United States actually leads the world in what's called small batch craft chocolate. Mm-hmm. There are more people doing it in the United States than anywhere else in the world. And we're actually
How can that be when you can walk through the streets of Paris and on every corner there is a Ma and Pa chocolate shop?
But as Chef Blunt pointed out, very few confectioners are making chocolate from the bean.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what the United States is leading in is small producers who are buying in cocoa beans who are making chocolate from the bean. And this is where the Americans are innovating and leading the world.
Now, Susan, there seems to be a concentration of candy makers, and this is more than just chocolate, but candy makers in Pennsylvania, in New York, in New Jersey, Illinois, Ohio, and California. Any reason for that?
There are a couple of reasons for it. Certainly, if you think of California and New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, they are coastal or near-coastal states, in the case of Pennsylvania, where it's easy to get your shipments of cocoa. Now, consider that cocoa grows in a very narrow area of the world, just 10 degrees north or south of the equator, so we don't grow it here in the United States, except for a very, very small amount
in Hawaii.
Yeah, in Hawaii.
But for the most part, it's coming to us from West Africa or South and Central America, or even in some cases from Asia. So it's good to be near a port where those cocoa beans are coming in.
David Murdoch's research campus up in Cabarrus County has a Hawaiian chocolate manufacturer. Is that right?
They have a small place called Waialua Estate on the north shore of Hawaii. Uh-huh. And it's supposedly the highest grown on that equator line. It's like 23.5 degrees north of the equator, that being the north shore of Hawaii. And it's very fragrant when you eat the chocolate. You pick up things like passion fruit. Mm. I've heard students say it comes in like coffee and chocolate, and then it finishes like with this guanabana passion fruit.
So are they making this up in at the research park?
No. He's obviously Dole. So the actual processor stateside. Mm. We say stateside for because it's not being. All the beans and everything are being fermented, dried and everything in Hawaii, and then they're being shipped over to San Francisco, and they're being processed. And he only sells it in like these little tiny tasting tab bars. They're really small, and you can find them in some of the boutique shops and even some of your grocery stores sell them as well.
Not only do we make a lot of candy here, do we have a lot of boutique candy makers in this country, but the world, Susan, seems to love our candy. We sell candy to Canada, Mexico, South Korea, Japan, Australia, Hong Kong, the Philippines, Panama, Singapore, and the United Kingdom. United Kingdom has what? Cadbury's, they have their own chocolate manufacturers. Why are they importing chocolate from the United States, all these different places?
Well, not just chocolate, but all candy. But, you know, the American brands are so famous around the world. People know what that Hershey wrapper looks like. They just know it. Wherever you go, they understand American brands, and they want to enjoy them as much as we want to enjoy things from other cultures as well. We really do import candy from the U.S. all over the world, and some of our largest multinational companies actually make some of their products in those regions. So making it even easier for people to be exposed to U.S. brands and have that same kind of love for them that we do.
And they want another piece of that Kit Kat bar, I guess.
That's right.
What's the
break.
What is the?
But it's also interesting to know about this that, for example, the Cadbury bars in the United States are manufactured by Hershey under license from Cadbury.
Okay.
So that you get people who are Cadbury aficionados and snobs who'll say that Cadbury in South Africa tastes better than Cadbury in Australia, tastes better than Cadbury in Canada. And a lot of it depends, of course, on where you grew up. It's, you know, the Vegemite Marmite, you know, it's all bad, but you know, the Australians like one and the Brits like another.
I think here in the U.S. we've actually gotten really good at our manufacturing techniques too. I think we've made things smoother, cleaner, better packaging, better processing. We've done a lot of those things.
Does any governmental organization inspect either the factories or the finished product, and do they regulate what goes into a finished product so that it can be labeled in such a way that it is what it says it is?
Ooh, that's a tricky one. We could all three jump in on this one. I mean, here in the U.S., we obviously have the Agriculture Department, and they do inspectors. You don't get like the local health inspector. You get an Agricultural Department inspector. Clay, let you address the whole what is legal and what is not legal. You're probably good on this one.
That's a subject for a huge other program.
Exactly.
But yes, there is something called the Code of Federal Regulations, which is all of the laws in the United States, and CFR 21.163 is the section which talks about what can and can't be in chocolate and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things which is really interesting about cocoa and chocolate is, and Chef, I'm sure this is something that you can talk about, is that we're starting to see a lot of more non-traditional uses as the world becomes more global and flavor traditions move from one part of the world to another. We're seeing some really exciting trends happening. So, for example, at the International Chocolate Awards where I was, I mean, one of the most interesting confluences I saw was somebody from Japan combining their sense of taste with classic French technique. And, you know, that I think is really something to look at in the next couple of years. I mean, I'm actually, when I leave the studio, I'm going to a kitchen and I'm cooking for a fundraiser tomorrow night called Brisket King here in New York City. And I'm going to make mole brisket soft tacos.
Yum.
So really, really playing with the notion of chocolate. Powder. I'm using a mole Mole Poblano, which
is a lot
the
of our
chocolate.
Listeners here in Charlotte know a lot about the whole mole. I mean, we have a very large Hispanic community here. The mole is huge. Huge.
But it can go so far beyond mole as well. Chocolate and cocoa are wonderful ingredients for savory food. At my wedding a few years ago, we served a cocoa and chili rubbed flank steak, and one of our appetizers was a cocoa dusted scallop with vanilla butter sauce. So there are so many different ways that you can experiment in savory applications with chocolate.
Yeah, we have New York City Beer Week coming up here, and I'm doing a 5-course tasting dinner with one of the local brew pubs around here, and that's really it. And another project I'm involved with, just speaking about, you know, taking, you know, where cocoa is growing, is that the cacao seed in the pod is surrounded by a pulp, and that pulp ferments, right, and it turns into a liquid.
So delicious.
It turns into a liquid, and it's alcoholic. Right. But in the countries where cocoa is grown, it's usually allowed just to drain on the ground. Some places will ferment it into a beer or a wine. But for hundreds of years, thousands of years, it's just been ignored. And one project I've been working on for the last couple of years is to take that juice, which is fermented, it's got alcohol in it, and convert it into a distilled spirit. And that's a real fun project because it really does push the boundaries of what our notion of cocoa and chocolate is.
Yeah, just don't serve it with chocolate. You're okay.
I don't want to run out of time before we talk about climate change, because this cocoa only grows, as we said, 1 or 2 degrees from the equator in either direction, something like that.
Yeah.
Has there been an impact? Are we seeing an impact of climate change on cocoa and its availability?
I mean, the World Cocoa Federation keeps us up to date on what's going on and the climate change. And I'll be honest, I haven't been able to keep up with it lately as much as I used to. But we were kind of scared there for a little while whether or not we were going to have, cacao growing off the trees, whether or not. And I think some of the companies, our larger companies, our Nestle's, our Hershey's.
Because the same thing's happening to coffee.
Yeah, they're reaching back into the farmers, the plantations themselves, and training the farmers how to produce better, more, be sustainable. Mm-hmm. A lot of these plantations are family owned, and the next generation doesn't want to hang out around the farm. They want to go somewhere else. So they're trying to teach the families that what they're doing is important and help them grow. So
I'm not going to ask Susan this question because she would put her in a very bad position as the vice president of communications of the National Confectioners Association. But here it's a trick question. Here it is. Valentine's Day is coming up. Would you be better off giving somebody a Whitman sampler or a box of Russell Stovers or going to a exclusive chocolate boutique and buying just a few choice pieces of chocolate?
Shop local. How's that? You can just say
very
that.
Political.
Shop local. Shop local. I mean, it's huge to shop local.
Is there anything
don't
wrong?
Worry, don't worry. The Russell Stovers and the ovens are going to be bought. They are. I'm not going to go to a 20 degrees chocolate shop and buy high-end marshmallows or truffles or whatever for my 5-year-old daughter's class.
So you're saying that Whitman samplers are for 5-year-olds?
No, I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying, who's your clientele? Are they chocolate snobs or are they just looking for a piece of
here's
chocolate?
Here's another trick question. Yeah. Maybe Susan can answer this.
Yeah.
I've gotten and given many Whitman samplers over the years, but I've never seen a box of Whitman's chocolate. I mean, they're always samplers. You can't just buy a box full of one kind of Whitman's chocolate.
Right.
Can you?
No, but Russell Stover does offer just singles variety.
You're right.
Okay. We have to stop. I'd like to talk more about this because I love chocolate and who doesn't love chocolate and candy? Susan Whiteside is the Vice President of Communications for the National Confectioners Association. Clay Gordon is the author of Discover Chocolate. And if you're a chocolate lover, you need to check out his website, thechocolatelife.com. And Chef Jeffrey Blunt, whose chocolates I'm about to taste in abundance, is a baking and pastry arts instructor at Central Piedmont Community College. Thank you all for the hour.